Okay, so welcome everybody for this year's fun. Nah, come on. For this year's fun exploration in things that no paid Samba developer ever will get paid to work on. I'm always joking that I'm one of the few hobbyist developers in the team, and I always go and pick fun talks that I feel like are really, really fun to work on. So I can actually motivate myself to use my spare time to actually work on that. But anyway, let's get into the whole thing. So I sort of already hinted that I'm not a professional Samba developer. My background is in computational biology. I've got a PhD in microbiology, and I do antibiotics research as my day job, so it's completely unrelated to this. But I'm a Samba team member, so I occasionally get to show up here and actually give a talk about Samba things. And so that's what I'm going to do. And so for this talk here, as a short idea of what you're getting into, is I'll talk a bit about Rust for people who missed my talk last year. I gave a short intro on Rust last year as well. I'll present the example project I've picked to figure out if Rust might be something we want to use in Samba development. And I'll talk a bit about the challenges that I've run into while doing that. And follow up with a couple of conclusions, because as an academic, I can't bear to like have a talk and not have any conclusions that I pontificate about. So as a quick intro on Rust, I guess the first question always is why? And some people might remember that 2 years ago, Jeremy Allison said in his keynote, the Samba project needs needs to think about using other safer languages. And so I figured, well, we might give it a try. So why really? The idea is that using a language like Rust, you can avoid whole classes of bugs. So Rust really makes sure you think about who owns what bit of memory and avoids a couple of problems like data races and things like that. Overall, of course, new languages have new features, so they might be a bit nicer to use for a couple of things, where C is getting a bit old and doesn't have the stuff that you need necessarily. It's getting harder to find C programmers, let's face it, right? I mean, a lot of the kids I deal with at university these days that haven't even heard of C anymore, so they think, like, if you can't do it in Python, it's not worth doing. No, I think that's not... So, that, like, scientific Rust libraries I haven't seen a lot yet, so the Python ecosystem there is pretty awesome. But no, I mean, still... it's getting harder to find C programmers because, I mean, if you... Yeah, I guess. So... yeah, I guess. So, I mean, there's a couple of things pushing people into different directions, but, I mean, even when I was doing my undergrad, our professors insisted that we'd learn Java instead of C because it was the better language. I'm not entirely convinced, but... There you go. So at the moment, sort of looking at Samba, it's 80% C and 7% Python, and then like the other stuff is weird other things like shell scripts and a bit of Perl, a bit of whatever, and there's probably like the odd nook and cranny where you can still find some JavaScript code and stuff like that. But overall, it's mostly C. It's around 2 million lines of code. I think that's before, so I think that's on a git clean output and then just slot count. And there's like 1 to 2 dozen regular contributors, so it's sort of as open source projects that are not driven by a single company or a consortium go, it's one of the larger open source projects there. So moving on to Rust, sort of going a bit feature-wise what they have. So it's a pretty new language. It was announced in 2010. It's very C-like. It's a compiled language, so compared to Python. I don't have it on here, but it's actually also a language that doesn't require runtime because it doesn't have garbage collection. So it's like from a perspective of somebody who's used to C, it feels pretty familiar, if not in the spirit, the spirit, the spirit, the spirit. They have a very strong focus on memory safety and have a lot of features in the compiler related to that. They have a package management system with the cargo tool that is decent as far as sort of these package repositories go. If you're used to C, where there's like no package management whatsoever and you need to rely on something else to like get all the dependencies, it's pretty nice. It's a bit of a moving target, I feel, because last year I was trying to do a Rust demo and I couldn't find an ASN1 library that worked for the demo I wanted to do. And I wasn't going to rewrite an ASN1 library just for the demo. And people told me, oh yeah, but you can get like some of these features to work if you just use the nightly builds. I was like, yeah, no thanks. And that is a spirit that is still very alive in the Rust community. So still, while researching and sort of playing around with the stuff I'm doing in this talk, people consistently pushed me to use the nightly builds because this is a feature that's not quite stable yet, but we'll get stable in maybe half a year. So just use the nightly build and just move on. And I don't know, I might be getting old and old-fashioned, but I feel like if we can't use it, like we can't use the stable language, we might not want to touch it yet, right? But it's a moving target and it's getting better, so I mean, might be worth reinvestigating. Also, one of the things I really find a bit cute is sort of programmers of Rust call themselves Rustations. I always think that's rather cute, especially because like us old C farts don't even have a nice word for like people who program C, apart from maybe us old C farts. So there you go. Yeah. Yeah, probably. Okay, so and of course, like you can't talk about a programming language without doing at least like a Hello World example. They're always really boring because I mean, obviously, there's nothing going on in the Hello World example. But there you go. Here's Hello World in Rust. So let's go and talk about the fun part. So I've decided to come up with an example project, and if you've read the description of this talk, you won't be terribly surprised, right? So the example project was built sort of with the idea in mind that the place where we wanted to make most sure that we have good memory safety, so no bad things happen to us, is when we have like the interface of Samba code to the bad network world outside, where we want to make sure that incoming network packages are parsed correctly and we don't have memory leaks, weird buffer overflows, stuff like that, right? So obviously, like the best place where we wanted to put memory safe first code in Samba would be on the network parsing layer. So the idea was to figure out how much work it would be to go and like do a DNS parser in Rust and then make Samba use the DNS parser written in Rust instead of going and using the PIDL-generated DNS parser that we're using at the moment. And then like build that parser as a shared library, link that with Samba and Profit, and like have like a great safe DNS parser in Rust. And I mean, if you go and look at the Rust book, there's a nice explanation on how you build a shared library in Rust, so, because I mean, obviously that was the first step to figure out, does this even work? And yeah, it's pretty straightforward. You basically just put in a lib clause in your cargo configuration file and basically say create type is dylib to build a dynamic library, because otherwise Rust will use its own proprietary format for the library, and then it will just build a shared object, and you can link against that, everything nice and peachy. So second experiment is, can we link one of these libraries with Samba? And so like the Rust stuff you build using cargo, the Samba stuff you build using WAF, and now cargo is a bit peculiar in like the way you use it, and saying that WAF, especially the WAF we use in Samba, is a bit peculiar in the way we use it, would be the understatement of the year. So I was like, yeah, it's very fiddly to do that, and it's not really exciting, and I could probably like give like at least one talk on sort of fighting with WAF to like get stuff built externally to somehow integrate with the Samba code. And I decided, nah, but that's not what I proposed. I actually wanted to look at, is Rust useful for us? So I decided, yeah, okay, so build a small demo, see if that works in principle, and then like once that works and we decide it's interesting, we can figure out how to link all of that together at some other point. So if you were looking into like an example of how to link Rust shared objects with Samba, sorry, I have to disappoint you. Maybe next year. So new plan is we come up with a simple like DNS-like protocol to like get an idea of the complexities in DNS, but sort of not the whole protocol. Build a parser of it in Rust. Build that as a shared library. Write a small C application that loads this, and then sort of we have pretty much the same idea of the initial thing, just without having to bother with like all of Samba. So that's what we're doing. So and I came up with the fancy talk protocol, as you can see here. If you've looked at DNS headers, it will be vaguely familiar. So it comes with an ID that uniquely identifies your request. It has a couple of bit flags following it, and then it has a couple of static fields. Here in my case, I decided I built sort of a chat protocol where you can go and query a server with a query message, and it will then respond with an answer string and can use the bit flags and the colors or the static fields here to tell you what ANSI modifications your terminal should be doing to the result string. So basically, you can go for like bold, italic, underline, blinking, and an RGB value of your choice. So that's the fancy talk protocol. And if you go and like take this protocol definition, it actually, yeah, okay. So already mentioned that the client sends a query giving an ID. The server looks up the query in the database. The server responds with the payload and uses the bit flags to tell the client how to format and color the response. And then the client just goes ahead and renders that. So that would be time for my first demo. So just to show how the protocol works. First, I need to start a server. And I've got a Rust example implementation to just see if my protocol library parsing library works at all, without going into the complexities of going from C to Rust and back. So starting up the server side is pretty straightforward. And then if I just run the client with a greeting, I just go contact the server, and the server responds with hello world, and it's in italic and orange. And I can do some other things. So there's a couple of known things that the server knows about. And if I ask it for something that it doesn't know, it will reply with not found. And as you can see, all of that is sort of rendered in different ANSI modifications, so different colors and different whatever font modifications or whatever you want to call that. Unfortunately, my terminal does not do blinking, because otherwise the not found would also blink. Maybe it's a good idea it doesn't do that. But
If you can compile the Rust program, why do you need to run it like this? Or, I mean, you said you can compile a Rust program, right?
Yeah.
So this looks like it's always compiling and then running it.
Oh yeah, but that's just because I'm always calling cargo run, which always checks if the command if the binary is up to date. I could go and just call. Debug client, so I could just call the whole thing. And then it wouldn't compile, right? So that's just a, during development, it was pretty good that it was sort of every time I reran it, it actually made sure it was using the most up-to-date version of the library. And that's just what the script is doing. Okay, so like proof of concept, the protocol works, it can do, well, sort of interesting stuff with it at least. It sort of vaguely resembles the workload of a DNS server. So there you go. That's what you want to be doing overall. And now, of course, the next idea would be like really going for the implementation, right? As the quote I have in here, I'm not sure how well that is visible, is sort of in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there of course is, right? So I've ended up having that on pretty much all slides I ever do because it's sort of always true. But so let's get back to the data structure on the Rust side of things, right? So even if you haven't seen Rust before but know a bit of C, it's pretty straightforward what's going on here. So I'm defining a public structure called package, and sort of the thing you need to get used to if you're coming from C is Rust, as a lot of the modern languages, puts the name first and then the data type afterwards. Looking at that, I have an enum because I wanted to more strongly type if it's a query or a response. Obviously, like for this simple protocol, it doesn't matter. But then, of course, if you were going for a DNS implementation where you have more different types of queries and things, you probably want to have something like that. And then basically, yeah, you can see that all the modificators you can pick are just booleans in here, and then red, green, and blue are just uints. And the sort of thing down there that maybe is a bit unusual is I have options for string, for query, and a payload, because one of the things that makes Rust memory safe is it doesn't have null as a value, right? So if I want to have something that might be there or might not be there, so like in C world, you would just like put in a pointer, and if the pointer is null, it's obviously not there, and then sort of you move on with your life. Here, you basically have to put an option, and the option encapsulates the other data type you mentioned, so in this case, a string. And then I can either have some string, or I can have none. And the compiler forces me, like every time I work with this, to actually go and make sure I have code for both cases that are possible. So just as a quick simplified version, because I didn't want to show the whole code, but this is basically how the Rust client works. So basically we define a query up on top. We set it to mutable because we want to futz with it. So another thing Rust does is, by default, all your variables are read-only, so you can write it only once, and then you can only read from them, and you need to explicitly say, no, this is a value I want to change stuff with. So you actually have to go and do that. If you leave out the mutable keyword in the definition, the compiler will just like step on your feet. And also, on the other hand, if you set something as mutable but never actually change it, the compiler will at least warn you that the mutable keyword in that position is unnecessary and that you should consider removing it. So that's one of the things I've learned while doing this project is the error messages from the Rust compiler are absolutely awesome. Right, so it's like the best error messages from a compiler I've seen so far. I mean, GCC is also getting much better with the error messages in like the recent years, but still, Rust, pretty awesome. But basically, every time it told me I was doing something wrong, it also had a suggestion what I might want to be doing instead, and I always could look at that and was like, yeah, that's right, that's what I wanted to do. I mean, if you typo a variable name and you have one that looks close, it's like, did you mean this, right? And stuff like that. So it's really, really nice. But anyway, let's get back in. I'm setting up an out buffer that I need to like encode my packet into so I can like send it out in the network interface. And one thing you notice here is that I have this weird block with a further indent in there that doesn't seem to be doing anything different. So it's basically there's no further, so there's no if statement or anything here. The only thing I need to do here while I have the block is I need to scope my encoder setup and writing to the encoder, because what you can see up here, so up here the encoder gets passed a mutable reference to the out buffer I'm using. So now the encoder it has sort of a write lock on that out buffer. And if I wanted to like use the buffer to send the query, I can't get a read lock on something where like another data structure holds a write lock. So this is where like this memory safety of Rust comes in. And by sort of putting this in a separate scope, because I don't actually need the encoder after having written all the things, I have the buffer that is filled with the encoded version that I want to send. And once the encoder goes out of scope, it releases its sort of write lock. And then I can, like in my send code, get a read lock on sort of a read-only reference to the buffer, so I can actually go and send it out in the network. And if you forget about doing that, it will tell you, no, you can't get a read-only reference here because like you're giving out a write reference up there. And just as it works with locking, so to me, that's sort of like the best context to try and think about this. Just as you have in locking, you can have multiple read locks. That's just fine. And then you can't acquire, so while somebody else still has a read-only reference to a thing, you can't get a writable reference to a thing, but you can have multiple read-only references to a thing. Right?
So package, encoder, decoder, they are like sort of classes or some of things?
So Rust works similar to C here, so there's no real classes, but you can sort of define implementation functions on a struct that then sort of work like member functions. It's a bit like you would do in, I mean, like Samba uses a lot of that, where you have a struct and then you have a bunch of functions that all take this struct as a pointer, and Rust has done this a bit more formalized, so it's objects, not classes. So there's no inheritance. Okay, so, I mean, basically, yeah, and then on the other side, of course, you sort of go and get the response back from the server, and then you sort of parse that again, and then you take care of pretty printing it. And on the Rust server side of things, it's also pretty straightforward, right? You have your the decoder that gets the query the client sent in. You use that to look up where your stuff is coming from. Then you encode it again. Again, I need to put the encoder into its separate scope, so it releases the lock on the out buffer. And then I can send back the response to the client. And that, of course, I want to run in a loop because I'm a server. So thinking about that, obviously the C server that we want to write works pretty much the same. So we receive the query into a buffer. We want to go and decode the packet. We want to look up the message. We want to encode the packet again and send a response to the client. So as the next thing, we can think about the API that we want to share. And because we're not structures with the implementations, we sort of go and write dedicated functions, and they look a bit like that. So we need to define some header file that gives us these definitions. So first of all, we need the struct. And second of all, we need like a decode package and an encode package function. And of course, if you've now paid attention at my shared API, you'll figure out, so hold on a moment. We're passing around pointers where we've put stuff in. So who owns memory of the packet struct that decode package returns, right? So if I parse it on the Rust side and allocate memory on the heap, it's Rust's heap, not the C program's heap. So yeah, I mean, basically there's like these two options that you have. So you can make Rust allocate the memory, and then of course, Rust needs to deal with it somehow. Or option two, of course, is you sort of pre-allocate the memory somehow in C and then sort of pass something that's large enough for the thing into Rust, and then Rust copies the memory over and you pass it back. So let's look at option one first. So Rust owns the memory, means Rust handles the memory allocation. C uses the structs and then needs to pass back stuff to Rust for deallocation. So basically, yeah, you have like a destructor function for everything that you need to sort of hand back to Rust so Rust can go and free the memory. So that would make the the overall API look a bit like that. So we like to the decode package and encode package. We have like a free package that can free a package, and we have a free buffer that can free a buffer. And of course, like thinking about this a bit more means that someone will forget to call the right free function at some point, right? It's not an if, it's a when, because this is like always going to happen. So just as a proof of concept, still you can make it work. So that's my second demo here. So this is now my fancy C server. And the C client pretty much works the same way. I just, like in the Rust server, I implemented my database as a little nice hash table of like string query to a result package. And then while writing the C thing, I was like, yeah, there's no real good hash map in standard C. So I decided, okay, let's not bother. So basically, it's always returning not found because I was too lazy to implement it. But it does work, and it's like the not found that the server returns. So in principle, you could make it work with a bit more effort. But yeah, I mean, as I said, new languages have a couple of new features that are actually nice and that actually mean you might want to use them because you get some nice stuff for free. But yeah, so in any case, so you can make it work. And sort of what happens here under the hood is that, as I mentioned, sort of the server calls into Rust to get the data structures, then goes and frees the memory once it's done with it, and everything is nice and shouldn't leak memory. I haven't run it in Valgrind yet, but I'm pretty sure it should be fine. Now, for the second option, which, to be fair, seems more attractive from the Samba perspective, is C should own the memory. Because, I mean, that means we're sort of making sure that the calling C code knows about the memory. And, I mean, for my demo server, actually, I found the Rust handles the memory option nicer because it's pretty straightforward. But if we, again, think about Samba being a bit more complex and Samba having Talloc to handle all the memory, like the only way I can think about sort of to make that work in the context of you parse a network package, you give back the structure, then you do some stuff with it, and on the way you decide, nah, I actually need to cancel this request here because, I don't know, the user doesn't have permission or something like that. So we run into one of the many error paths and decide, okay, abort. And then we do a Talloc free, and then Talloc usually like frees all the memory. But now we need to remember, like maybe like five or six layers above the call that actually called into Rust, how to parse the stuff back into Rust. And I'm sure you could do something with like Talloc context that you attach a like destruction function to that then calls into Rust or something fiddly like that. But that doesn't seem to be like the way you actually want to go. So let's turn this around and say, okay, C owns all the memory. So C also takes care of freeing the memory. And then that only means that Rust needs to allocate the memory in a way that C can free. And the idea would be, okay, so let's just use Talloc from within Rust, right? So as a short detour, let's have a look at what it takes to implement Talloc in Rust. Got a bit sidetracked on that one, but I mean, basically the idea is we use the foreign function interface that we want to like get the Rust stuff into C to get the Talloc library into Rust first. And then basically, I mean, all we really need is we need like the Talloc name const function and the Talloc free function, and then we're good. Right? Everything else is sort of like syntax sugar on top of that. So, and a couple of debugging functions, but who needs debugging, right? And then we add like a Rust layer on top of that to make that feel like native Rust code. Because I mean, in the end, if you're using stuff that forces you to basically write C code in different language, you haven't won a lot, right? Because it's going to be painful in different ways. So the idea is to have a foreign function interface in Rust that looks a bit like that. So basically, you need to tell Rust about a couple of the C types that you can use by using the correct trait here. And then you basically just need to say, like, a link to Talloc, and it will sort of figure out that these functions need to be linked in from the Talloc library, and then you basically just go and say extern and give the definitions of the function, just like a header file would work on the C side of things. And now, like having done that, with like all of that that is needed, you have like the core functions available in Rust. So that was pretty easy, but still, of course, needs some wrapping because none of these data types are sort of native to Rust.
So you don't need to sort of map. It uses the same name exposes in Rust when you use that. Okay.
Yeah. And because this is in sort of a Rust module, it's actually hidden away in a separate namespace if I want to use it. Right? And then sort of you think about how the Rust data structures work that allocate heap memory. It's sort of the core data structure in Rust that allocates memory on the heap is just called box, and it's sort of a generic thing that you can tell in these square brackets what sort of data type it should allocate the memory for. So the idea would be to have like a Talloc context that works a bit like Rust, but instead of allocating memory on the Rust heap, it will just ask Talloc for the memory. And then we can use that to allocate memory for everything that we need to transfer back into C, because then if we get passed in the original Talloc parent pointer in the call, it will all be sort of stuck to the proper Talloc pointer, and then Talloc free will just do the right thing. So that's a bit what the implementation looks like. So basically, we implement a generic Talloc context over the generic type T, and that has a new function to create a new Talloc context that takes a generic Talloc context of type U, which is like another type, because the way Talloc works is like every pointer that you allocated by Talloc is also a Talloc context that you can use for other things. And we do that by just having void pointers, and Rust really, really doesn't like that. So you have to do this fancy dance with all these different generic types here in order to make this work. But then in the end, you sort of go and do a bit of a resolution here, and you can actually see how this option stuff works in Rust. So I have this match, and then basically if I have a parent, so there's something in the pointer here, I just go and grab the actual pointer hidden in the context. And otherwise, I just use the null pointer definition that exists for doing these foreign function interfaces. And then just call into Talloc name const and get my pointer. And then, in order to make this fit on the slide, I actually don't do any null checking or anything on the return. But sort of in general, I then just create a new Talloc context and return that. And then the other thing I need to set up is there's a drop trait for data types that you generate, and those get called when the compiler decides that the scope of some data type has run out, and that basically is the destructor that then gets run. And basically, again, the thing that we need to be doing is we just need to call Talloc free and sort of move on with our life. One thing that is a bit annoying, and I'm not sure how to solve that nicely, is the drop function that gets called and that is defined in the drop trait doesn't give you a good way of returning error messages. So I'm not quite sure how to sort of deal with that, but I'm also not sure in what context Talloc free can fail that we actually don't want to die anyway in. So, I mean, this is something, you can probably figure that out. I just didn't spend a lot of time on that. So unsafe basically tells the compiler that in this area, there might be some stuff going on that is not necessarily strictly safe. And I'm telling you, compiler, that I looked very carefully at the code in this unsafe block, and I can guarantee that, sort of as the programmer, it is in fact safe. Right? In this case...
So why don't they call it safe then?
Yeah. So I mean, it's a bit difficult, but I mean, if you call it across different sort of programming languages, at some point you need to trust that the pointer that is passed into your stuff actually is a valid pointer. And I mean, technically, if you were to write that in a really safe manner, then obviously you need to add a lot of checks. But again, in the interest of fitting the code on the slides, I haven't done that. Right? Unfortunately, that's not everything, right? So we have these like query and payload things, and they take a string. And a string is a heap-allocated data type in Rust. So we need some more types, right? So obviously we need like a talloc string type, and I mean, probably we're going to need some arrays at some point. So obviously we also want to have some sort of a talloc vector. And I mean, probably we need to go and have a look at the Rust definitions and make sure that we have talloc versions of all the heap allocated things. So we're going to write a lot of boilerplate stuff for the overall thing. So the alternative idea would be to make talloc usable as a global allocator in Rust. So there's an allocate trait that you need to implement in order to be usable as a generic global allocator. Unfortunately, it's not a stable feature yet. So again, as I said, right? So people were like, yeah, just use the allocate trait. It's easy. And I was like, OK, fair enough. My compiler doesn't have it. Oh, yeah, you're not running the nightly then. It's like, OK, where? So much for that idea. But I mean, maybe like in the long run, that might be the way to go. Also, I guess if you're really interested, I think like doing a nice talloc Rust port actually also is possible without this. It's just a bit of busy work that I wasn't initially planning on doing when I started working on this example project. So that also is the reason that I haven't finished the talloc port. So there's no demo of using talloc with that. But I mean, you can see, I guess, in the end, like it's pretty straightforward. It's probably also going to work decently. So I'll just sort of follow up with a couple of conclusions. So of course it was less easy than I had hoped for, because if you look at the examples in the Rust documentation, all of them are really nice. Until you look a bit closer and realize they're only passing very trivial data types, like int, right? And so like the moment you start passing interesting complex structs, life isn't that easy anymore. If we want to use this, we need to decide what sort of memory handling method we actually want to use. I personally feel that probably talloc is the way to go, just because that integrates really nicely into the overall architecture. But still, I mean, somebody needs to do that. We need to figure out how to integrate the build systems, because I mean, if we want to use it, it needs to somehow like come together. And how do we handle Rust as a dependency? I still remember when we switched a lot of our sort of management scripts and stuff to Python, and there was like this big outcry saying, well, it's unreasonable to demand that Python is installed in the system. And like at that point, I wasn't very convinced that this is actually a reasonable objection to have, but Rust on the other side is still pretty new. And like if we want to go and start using like the allocate trait, which hopefully becomes like stable maybe in the next half year, we would sort of be running cutting edge stable release of Rust, and that will be on no distribution out there ever, right? So it's a bit interesting on how to handle that.
Just have a build system download the nightly.
Yeah, I guess, right? That would be the way. On the other hand, sort of dealing with all these problems I had, I found the Rust community overall to be really, really helpful. So I mean, that is like a plus on the Rust side of things. And sort of just finishing up with like work still to do is like doing a proper like talloc sys implementation. So this sys ending always means it's a wrapper for a native library in Rust. Of course, like the elephant in the room is you don't actually want to write all of that code manually, because what I haven't shown you is that like apart from the nice data structure I had in Rust, I have another copy of that that I can actually pass across the FFI. So there's lots of data structure duplication and lots of conversion going on in order to make that work in the end. But of course, if we also generate the code, it doesn't really matter, right? We can like generate the two different copies. And of course, there's build system integration, which I really don't look forward to. Yeah, I guess in the end, if you want to do it, that's what we need to be doing, I guess. And with that, I'm done, and thanks for all your attention.
Thank you.
So what can't you do in Rust?
What can't you do in Rust? So I feel like if you want to be a bit more relaxed about what sort of data structures you have, the way we like have a lot of code in Samba where we have void pointers, but then there's some talloc magic to still know what data type it is, much, much harder to do in Rust. So I feel if you sort of go and want to have like really generic code, then that might actually be a bit complicated.
Well, the reason for asking is we are writing a lot of new code and which is could be standalone. So the question is, it could completely be in Rust.
Yeah, so I guess if you can like completely build on Rust, I feel that that might be an interesting thing. I'm not sure how good Rust is with cross-compilation for like a bit more exotic platforms and weirder Unixes that I haven't looked at.
Nobody cross-compiles CTDB.
Yeah, true. You want the clicker? It's complaining about
any more questions so far?